You're listening to the Westchester Podcast, an official podcast of the New York City Church of Christ.
Good morning, church. It is August already, in case you hadn't noticed. And what that means for me is that we got about one more month left of summer. Now, I don't want to depress you or anything, but that's just how my mind works. And what that also means, I mean, my wife this week was just talking about how the back-to-school sales are going to be coming soon. And that awful, dreadful place, Woodbury Common, will be a destination for my family. Now, this usually means shopping. My idea of shopping is you have a list and a set of items that you wish to purchase. You find a retailer of your choice, you go in, you purchase said items, and then you leave. My wife's idea is a little more artistic than science, right? She wants to compare and see this pink dress versus this pink dress, which look entirely the same to me. But for her, it's more of an art. I know for me, I would rather pay more than deal with the agony of trying to find a good deal. You know, and then there's stores like Target, which to me is an exercise in insanity. Like from where I am in England, where we were born, we don't have shops that large with that much stuff. They got the name right, because Target seems to be a target on my peace of mind and my wallet. But so many people are excited by getting a good deal, right? Some people just know how to negotiate. I'm not good at it. I don't know how to like play that game. I just don't want to be rude. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. There was one time I wanted to buy a car, and I took this brother, Frank Taylor, with me. And if any of you guys know Frank Taylor, Frank knows how to get a deal. And so I was just, the guy told me the price I was about to pay. Frank was like, bro, just hold on a second here. And it's like he didn't do anything. It was like some Jedi mind trick. He just asked the guy loads of questions, and the guy dropped his price by a few thousand dollars. It was amazing. And I've had some sales training, and sales training, they say the first person to speak loses the deal. But to me, that silence is deafening. I can't handle that. Why am I talking about all of this? Because I think sometimes in our relationship with God, it can be like we're trying to get the best deal. It can be like, what am I going to get out of this? What's it worth? How do I negotiate here? And what is God going to give me? So the title of my message today is very simple, Making a Deal with God. Go to Genesis chapter 15. And we're going to look at cutting a deal with God, what it's going to cost you, and then we're going to look at some of the hidden costs. See, as we go into Genesis chapter 15, we're going to talk about an interaction between Abraham and God. And we've got to look at the background of this time. Right now, God is building his relationship with Israel. And in the other societies around, they had made their gods. I think I talked about this a little bit the last time I spoke. And one in particular was an agricultural society. They used to worship Baal. And they were worried about whether their crops would grow, whether they would get rain or even human fertility, whether they could give birth and whether their crops could give birth. So they needed an answer for these things, and they created a god that would give them answers so long as they kept sacrificing to this god. You see in 1 Kings chapter 18, when Elijah is going up against the prophets of Baal, that the more that Baal doesn't answer, the more that they dance, the more that they sacrifice, to the point of even cutting themselves. As people, we can be stuck in Baal worship. And this is what I mean. Am I doing enough, God? Am I sacrificing enough? Am I working hard enough? If I pray more, if I serve more, do I get enough points to get what I want? And it's how we operate because it's how the world operates that we live in, right? You go to work, nobody gives you a paycheck for free. And so when it comes to our relationship with God, we can have this same transactional type of approach. I do this, I get this. So my first point is cutting a deal with God. Let's read through this scripture. Genesis chapter 15. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abraham. I'm your shield, your very great reward. But Abram said, Sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer, son of Damascus? And Abraham said, You've given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir. Then the word of the Lord came to him, This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir. He took him outside and said, Look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to them, So shall your offspring be. Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. He also said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession to it. But Abram said, Sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it? So the Lord said to him, Bring me a heifer, a goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon. Abraham brought all these to him, now listen to this, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite each other. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. Then birds of prey came down on the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. The sun was setting. Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not reached its full measure. When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking firepot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, To your descendants I will give this land from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, from the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Raphaites, Amazites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. So what's happening here? Here's God as he's building a relationship with Abram and people of Israel, and he starts off by saying, I am your God, I am your reward. Not the results. I am your shield, I am your reward. And then Abraham is saying, look, what can you give me, God? I need to know what you're going to give me, and I need assurance of what I need to do to get those things. These promises sound great, but these other gods you've got to sacrifice to. You've got to do the temple worship and the rituals. Some places you need to cut yourself. Some places you need to even give up your kids. How can I gain this possession? And I think that's a question that a lot of us ask God. How will things work out with my kids? How will things work out with my job, my life, my marriage, my parents? What is my future? How is all this going to happen? And what will the sign be? We go to verse 9, and we see this strange thing where God asks Abraham to bring these animals, cuts them in halves, and separates the pieces. And so the question is, why does God do this? Well, back then, if you wanted to make a deal with somebody else in business, you would get some livestock, you would cut the livestock in half, you would separate them, and then both parties would walk through the separated pieces, and they would say to each other, may it be to me as these animals if I don't uphold my end of the bargain. So that's how they made a deal back then. So now God is saying, cut up these animals. So Abraham knows, okay, a deal is about to be made here. And so maybe he's anxious about, okay, what's it going to mean? What's going to happen here? And then you go down to verse 17, he has a dream and there's a smoking fire pot. The smoking fire pot, we won't go into it, but it's a representation of who God is. Who goes between the pieces of the animals? It's just a smoking fire pot. See, to make a regular deal, both parties would go through. But right here, it is just a smoking fire pot that goes through. What God is saying is, the things that I'm promising you, the security for your life, your future generations, your unborn child, will not come because of any sacrifice that you've given. I'm going to do all of the work. This is a different God. I don't require any of your sacrifices. The promise of offspring and as many as stars in the sky was not dependent on anything that Abram would do. It was all God. And I don't want to sound like a prosperity preacher here, but whatever God has for you in your life, it's yours already. There is nothing you can do to take it away. All God requires is your faith and your belief that he can do it. See, what happens when we have transactionalism is it creates anxiety in our relationship with God. Maybe I don't have what I want because of something that I did. Maybe I'm in some sin. It's still some form of Baal worship. God hasn't answered me. I must be doing something wrong. And even the spiritual things, what is God trying to teach me? Sometimes it's us trying to find control. We got to let go. God is saying, you don't have to worry about if you measure up. You don't have to worry about if you're doing the right thing, because in this relationship, I'm a new God. I have done all the work. No more guilt, no more insecurity, no more wondering what is coming to you. It's not dependent on you. You need to believe and just be. But see, it's hard for us to just be. What do we want? 5 easy steps to dot, dot, dot. Right? We want the Easy Steps magazines. You see them over and over again. Just do step 1, step 2, step 3, and you have the perfect body. Doesn't work like that. We all know that. What do you need to do to just be? Well, it wouldn't make sense for me to tell you what to do to just be. I think we need to meditate. We need to pray. But the first point is God is your shield. He is your very great reward. And he has done it all. This phrase, the phrase cutting a deal, this is where it comes from. From cutting the two animals in half and agreeing on a deal. God is the one who is going to do it all. Point number 2, we're going to go into the New Testament, Luke chapter 15. What's it going to cost me to be saved? The tax collectors and sinners all came to listen to Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to complain, look, this man welcomes sinners and even eats with them. Then Jesus told them this story. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep but loses one of them. Now let's just stop there. Because this is what I love about the scriptures. There's so much in these few little sentences. First of all, the tax collectors and the sinners came to Jesus. Who were these? These were the undesirables. And the Pharisees are watching. This is the religious establishment. And so they're thinking, I'm doing all the right things. I have my point system. I am righteous. God is going to bless my life. And they're looking at these tax collectors and sinners as people who are bringing down the people of Israel. God is not blessing us because of these people. And then Jesus comes in, and he's eating with these sinners. Now, to eat with people at that time was acknowledging and accepting them. It was saying, these people are okay, I acknowledge them. And Jesus is eating a meal with these guys, and the Pharisees are saying, look at who he's eating with. And then the next sentence is, suppose one of you has 100 sheep, and he's talking to Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees look down on farmers because to touch dead animals, to be cleaning animals, was considered unclean. So the fact that Jesus is saying to Pharisees, suppose one of you guys has 100 sheep, they would never have 100 sheep. It would be like me saying to you guys, you know what it's like when you're trying to do a drug deal? Like, you'd look at me like I was crazy, right? So this is how Jesus is talking to them. And so they're immediately offended because he's saying, look, everybody is a child of God, not just those who are righteous. Then he goes on, let's continue reading. He says, then he will leave the other 99 sheep in the open field and go and look for the lost sheep until he finds it. And when he finds it, he happily puts it on his shoulders and goes home. He calls to his friends and neighbors and says, be happy with me because I found my lost sheep. In the same way, I tell you, there is more joy in heaven over one sinner who changes in his heart and life than over 99 good people who don't need to change. Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins but loses one. She will light a lamp, sweep the house, and look carefully for the coin until she finds it. And when she finds it, she will call her friends and neighbors and say, be happy with me because I have found the coin that I lost. In the same way, there is joy in the presence of the angels when one sinner changes his heart and life. These next three parables are really talking about our relationship with God. And as Jesus tells these stories, we've got to look a little deeper. The sheep is lost, and it needs to be rescued. And back then, to rescue a sheep might mean 3 days of traveling to find the sheep. And then it says, puts it on his shoulders. So 3 days of carrying the sheep back into the fold. You look at the woman. She lights a lamp. She sweeps the house. She looks carefully until she finds it. What is the point here? The point is, it takes effort for God to find us. It takes effort for him to find the sheep and bring it back in. It takes effort for the coin to be found. Now, what does the coin or the sheep have to do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. They just need to be found. And so many times we're trying to figure out what we need to do. If it was dependent on the sheep, nothing would happen. And the story tells two different stories. The sheep in the far country, right, in the field. So we can be lost and out there in the world. And the coin that is lost inside the house. We can be lost within the church, within the religious system, as much as we can be lost out there. We can be lost outside the church and outside of God, or when we're inside, we can become judgmental of those who are not like us. We can come into a situation where we don't forgive people, where we assume the worst of each other. We are all sons and daughters of God. Maybe somebody doesn't worship the same way that you do. Maybe the way their speech or their customs or their culture is different. Maybe the way they express themselves is different from the way that you do. And we can look down, just like the Pharisees, because it's different. And we can be lost while we're in here together. We've got to start to check our hearts. You know, for me, it's very clear for me in my conversion story that God came after me, repeatedly. I'll try to go through it quickly. I got reached out to while I was just about to be homeless. I was here from London, England. I was on a scholarship to train as a dancer, and I had a place to stay for about a month, and then that place was gone. And so I had about three, four more days, and my plan was to go take the train to JFK, sleep in JFK, and take the train back in to audition. That was my plan. Great plan. So I go to this audition, and then this guy starts talking to me. Now, I was a dancer, so when other males start talking to you, you start assuming different things. So I'm like, why is this? This seems too friendly. He's smiling. He's saying how great of a dancer I was. I'm like, I've just met you. What's the deal here? So he reaches out to me, then he starts talking about church. I don't know about all of that. So I leave that audition. I had two auditions that day. I went to a second audition, right? So at the second audition, he happens to be there as well with two other disciples. And so I'm auditioning, and they're standing at the door, all three of them, male, looking at me and smiling. So I'm like, okay, this is weird, but I figure if I got a fight, I can take these guys and I can run. So they start talking to me, and they're following me out of the audition, and they're trying to find out about my life in England, and it's just weird. So anyway, we get to talking, and then I'm like, look, I'm probably not going to have a place to stay. And they said, all right, you can stay with us. Again, more weirdness. But I was like, look, I don't have any choice. So I stayed with the brothers. Long story short, they studied the Bible with me. In actual fact, Jim was one of the first sermons I ever heard when I came into the church. And so they studied with me, and you know, I was getting further along. And my mom, who's with me, she's a disciple in England, in Los Angeles. I called my mom. I said, this is what these guys are saying. They're saying I'm not a Christian. My mom's like, you need to get out. That is a cult. They are not of God, and you need to leave. And so if it wasn't weird enough already, and I was staying in their place, then everything's, you know, when you have that in the back of your mind, everything is weird, right? Why did you say hello at that time, in that place, in that way? So one day I'm staying in their apartment, all of the brothers leave, and I leave with the brothers because they're like, you know, you're going to leave with us, you're not going to leave here in the apartment. And my bag was there. And so bag was there, and I'm like, how am I going to get out of this? My bag's there, I don't want to see him again. And so I went back to the apartment. I couldn't get in. I saw there was an opening in the window. I climbed up the side of the building. I jumped over the partition, climbed through the door, got my bag, and left. That was the first time they started the Bible with me. Then I went to Dance Theatre Harlem. I was training there, and Zalika was in the company there. She was in the company, and then there was another sister who was there, and they would reach out to me, and I would push them away, especially when I found out what church they were in. And then I got injured, and nothing was working in my life. Struggling. And at that time, I was like, okay, God, whatever it is, I'll go looking for it. If it's these guys, I'll go looking. And that week, it was like 5-6 different disciples. And then, because I would see them, I'd see them at different times and run away. And then I was sitting on the train, I looked up, and the guy who first reached out to me in the dance studio was standing right over me. So, hey, what's up? I'm like, listen, man, I've been thinking about coming back. He's like, ah, okay. Then I studied the Bible and eventually got baptized, but that was 3 years. So the God, I know what's coming after me, out there, lost in the out country. God will still come after you. If you're studying the Bible, God is coming after you. He's trying to bring you in. He's trying to put you on his shoulders and bring you back into the fold. Christians, God still comes after you in your everyday life to help you resolve conflict, to show you that you're loved, you're worth it, you are enough. God is saying, I will run through the fields with you, I will shine the light to rescue you from whatever is lost in your life. Whether it's relationships, family, healing, insecurity, fear, anxiety, you just need to let me find you. Stop hiding. Some of us, if we were the coin, we would have scoot over to the side so that the light missed us. Stop hiding from having those talks you need to have. Stop hiding from being vulnerable in the way you need to be vulnerable with the people in your life. Stop hiding from reading the Bible, from confessing. See, your part in the deal, God doesn't require anything. The other thing is we see that Jesus is hanging out with these so-called sinners and undesirables. I think as a church, we've got to watch with our agenda-based Christianity. Yes, we want to save people, and I've even heard it preached, and sometimes I've said stuff similar to it, that of course we love with an agenda. We want to save people. So if they're not studying the Bible, then we need to move on and love somebody else. See, Jesus was sitting with the undesirables, but he wasn't just sitting with them. He was laughing. He was talking. He was engaging in conversation with them. And get this, he didn't even require them to follow him. It doesn't say these people followed him. It doesn't say they fell down and started worshiping him. It says none of that. It just says he sat with them. Despite what anybody else thought, despite what any of the other religious people were thinking, he sat with them, gave him his love, and gave him his time. God in his contract does all the work. The agenda for us is just to love. And sometimes we've got to sit with people who people might think you're crazy for sitting with. Now, we obviously have to be wise. But look, I like connecting with people. That's just me, right? Whether it's one-on-one, whether it's, you know, with a group of people, I just think people are interesting. But I think even still, sometimes with me, I'm like, I've got to watch it. I've got to be careful. Of course, you've got to be careful from being corrupted by the world. But I think some of that fear-based Christianity makes us weird. When we could just be enjoying a relationship. When somebody maybe years later is going to come back and say, you know what? I thought Christians were all judgmental. I didn't think any Christian would listen to me. And sometimes maybe that's it. Or maybe they do. I've had people come out, come to church, get baptized, and that's awesome too. But we've got to understand, we've got to love people without limits and not be like the Pharisee. God came after us over and over and over again. We've got to keep going for people over and over and over again until Christ's love overflows. You know, in our church, I don't want to belabor this point, but we've got to start trusting each other. We don't all talk the same. We don't all look the same. And look, someone might say something that is insensitive, but you've got to trust the intention and you've got to trust the heart behind it. Because I think we go places. And especially in the climate in America right now, it's easy to go there, right? It's all of the hot button issues get pressed. And we go right there. But I think we've got to take a step back. We don't have to ignore the very real history and the very real issues and the very real facts. No, I'm not saying ignore that. But I think as Christians, we've got to step back, give people the benefit of the doubt, ask more questions, learn from people. It's said that every table is an altar. You look through the Bible and Jesus eats with people. The reason he's eating with people is not just because he was hungry all of the time. He was making a statement. We got to eat, sit, listen, be in each other's lives, find a place of understanding, and then God can move. Well, what about meeting with these people if they're all in sin? Well, what about sin? Your sin or their sin? We've got to watch how judgmental we are. Love them, and if they decide after reading the scriptures they want to become a Christian, then great. But if not, you got to keep loving them. Does this make you uncomfortable? Who can you think of right now? What group of people can you think of right now in this second if you were to sit across from them in a study or even just a conversation would make you uncomfortable? Put that in your head. Those are the people we need to love and go after. Third point. We're going to go to the prodigal son. Third point is the hidden cost. So I'm going to go into this and we're going to go through pretty quickly, but I want us to take a fresh look at this because I think when we look at the prodigal son, we've heard it so many times that we can kind of think, yeah, I've had an argument with my parents and so that kind of relates to this point. When that really, it's so far removed from that. I remember at one point I was staying with my grandparents and I ran away from home. And so when I think of this story, I think of that time when I ran away from home for a few days, and I'm like, yeah, I can kind of relate. But the more we study, the more we see how much further the father has to go to express his love. Luke chapter 15, verse 11. Then Jesus said, a man had two coins. The younger son said to his father, give me my share of the property. So the father divided the property between his two sons. Then the younger son gathered up all that was his and traveled to a far away country. So, we have to realize how dramatic this is. At this time, an inheritance was given at death. The father was to accumulate something, and the younger son was entitled to a third. The older brother, was entitled to two-thirds. Now, what we see here is what is he asking for? He's not asking for an inheritance. He's asking for property. Now, the difference is, if he had gotten an inheritance, which was due at death, he would have had to keep the father's name, continue the father's business and name in, do everything in the father's name. He would have to build a house for the father. But the fact that he's not asking for his inheritance, but property, means he didn't have to do any of that. It was like he was saying, I want what's mine, I don't care if you have to drop dead, and I don't even want to carry your name. In this time, this was an astonishing request, especially with the people who revered honoring their mother and father. And now he was asking for the property and taking it out of the father's hands, which he would need this property to make more money. So he's taken more money out of the father's hands, more money out of the family hands, and more money out of his brother's hands. The father, traditionally, if a son was to disrespect him in this way, was supposed to take his left hand and slap his son across the face in public and publicly humiliate him. Then the other thing that's happening here is as he gathered up all of his property and started to sell it and left. What that means is not that he just had money and he left, but that he would gather up this property that the father had given him, and then he would have to go through town and have somebody purchase it to get the money. And the father would have to be there with him, signing off. So not only has he disgraced his father, but publicly he's embarrassing his father by dragging him through town. Everyone sees his father signing this stuff off for the son who has no respect for him. And everybody's thinking, you should have just slapped this guy across the face and left him. You're going to allow this son to publicly embarrass you when you have all of this? God gives us talents. God gives us gifts. God gives us our free choice. But we've got to understand when we decide to walk away, we can humiliate him in this way. It's not just simply, I had a tiff with my father. But to them, it meant so much more. What the son doesn't realize, it's not about the money, but it's about the shame and the broken love between him and his father. God gives us freedom so that we can even reject his love. And I think sometimes it's easy for us to think, I'm not like this guy. But the story is, we are this guy. Let's keep going. There he wasted his money in foolish living. After he'd spent everything, a time came when there was no food anywhere in the country. And the son was poor and hungry, so he got a job with one of the citizens there who sent the son into the fields to feed pigs. The son was so hungry that he wanted to eat the pods the pigs were eating. But no one gave him anything. When he realized what he was doing, he thought, all of my servants' fathers, now listen to this again, all of my servants' fathers have plenty of food, but I am here almost dying with hunger. I will leave and return to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son, but let me be like one of your servants. So the son left and went to his father. So he was in another country, basically was far away in a Gentile country. He'd abandoned his traditions and his spiritual principles. He wasted all of his inheritance, and he was basically a day laborer, the worst job you could ever have, feeding pigs. Now, the Bible says when he realized what he was doing. Some scriptures say when he came to his senses. Stay with me here. Some scholars say that when this phrase is not that when he came to his senses and he repented, but when he got wise, when he got smart, he figured, all right, I'm hungry. My father has stuff. Let me go back and get the stuff. It's really more about him than it is about any repentance at this point. He doesn't say, let me go back and be a slave. The word he uses is like one of your hired servants, like one of your skilled laborers. Some people think that he wanted to go back, make the money, and pay back his father. So here, he knows he's done wrong. He knows he's in need. He wants to have food. He's figuring out in his own mind, let me go back. What does he say? He says three things. Father, I've sinned against God and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Let me be like one of your hired servants. Let's look at that first phrase and what it meant at that time. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. Turn with me to Exodus chapter 10. Why did Jesus use this phrase? In Exodus chapter 10, after God has sent the plague of locusts on Pharaoh, and Pharaoh was feeling like he was almost ready to submit to God, Moses comes back. Pharaoh summons Moses, and in verse 16, what does he say? Pharaoh quickly summoned Moses and Aaron and said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now forgive my sin once more and pray to the Lord your God to take this deadly plague away from me. He wanted to get out of his bad situation. Moses then left Pharaoh, prayed to the Lord, and the Lord changed the wind to a very strong west wind, which caught up the locusts and carried them into the Red Sea. Not a locust was left anywhere in Egypt, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go. His heart was still unrepentant. So when Jesus uses this particular phrase, the people at the time would have understood what he is saying is, this guy is saying the right things, but his heart is not there yet. And just like us, we can say the right things, but our heart is not there yet. So he comes back. His heart God is working on his heart, but it's not there. He's still unrepentant. Now, the father sees the son while the son was still a long way off. His father saw him, felt sorry for his son, and ran to him, hugged him, and kissed him. What's going on here? The son, a far way off, was at the edge of the city. First of all, Middle Eastern men of wealth would not run because it would mean they would have to pull up their tunic. And it would mean their legs were shown, which was an embarrassment and a shame. And so here's the father running to the edge of town to meet his son at the edge of town. It was an embarrassment. Why does he want to meet him at the edge of town? Because at that time, there was a ceremony called kezaza, which meant the cutting off. And it was a specific ceremony for somebody who had left town and wasted their money and was trying to come back into town. And what they would do is they would break a pot in front of the son as he entered town to say, the relationship with you, the community, your family is broken. And it would be an embarrassment, and the son would not be able to come back into the community. So the father is running to the edge of town to meet the son before he's embarrassed by the community. And then this scripture says he kissed him. The Greek word is more that he showered kisses on him. So the father took embarrassment upon embarrassment upon embarrassment. And then when he comes back, the son doesn't even get to his third sentence because the father has welcomed him, put a ring on him, a robe on him, and is welcoming him back into the community. This is a lot more than just an argument between a father and son. This is how what God will do to bring us back into the fold. It's about the broken relationship. The son doesn't get into his third sentence, and the father is saying, there will be no kazaza here because I have shown that I've accepted my son back into the fold. The father had the right to slap his son, to reject his son. The village had the right to cut the son off. But God wanted his son back. If you've messed up, God just wants you back. If you've walked away, God just wants you back. If you keep pushing God away, he's running to you. He wants you back at home with him. And if you're doing good, remember, he's going to do whatever he can to run, embarrass himself, sacrifice his son, watch his son die, watch his son bleed, so that he can bring you back into the fold. I think when we look at it in context, the love is so much more. Finally, verse 25. The older son was in the field, and as he came closer to the house, he heard the sound of music and dancing. So he called to one of the servants, and he asked what all this meant. The servant said, your brother has come back. Your father has killed the fattened calf because your brother came back home safely. The older son was angry and would not go to the feast. So his father went out and begged him to come in. But the older son said to his father, I have served you like a slave for many years, and I've always obeyed your commands. But you never gave me a young goat to have at my feast with my friends. But your other son, who has wasted all your money on prostitutes, comes home and you kill the fattened calf for him. The father said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. We had to celebrate and be happy because your brother was dead, but he is alive. He was lost, but now he's found. What's happening here? There's a banquet and there's a celebration, and his older son is outside. He won't even come in. This was further humiliation to the father. And back in those times, if you embarrassed your father publicly, again, a slap across the face. The older son refuses to come in. What's he saying? I've built my spiritual resume. I've done all of these things. I deserve it. I've been keeping score. And you give this degenerate what's mine. It's not fair. And he says, you were always with me, and everything that I have is yours. He's saying, look, so you thought by doing these things I would love you more? It's that transactionalism again. You thought you were scoring points? You thought that your good deeds elevated you? It's self-righteous. See, the first son's bad deeds separated him from his father. The second son's good deeds separated him from his father. And the same can be said of us. What is the hidden cost? It is the pain of the father, the humiliation, the heartache, and the shame of the father. And the greatest line for me is, son, you were always with me, and all that I have is yours. We could have partied at any time. We could have sacrificed the fattened calf at any time. I think as Christians, sometimes we miss the joy of being a disciple because we're trying to do enough. We're trying to score points. We've got our spiritual resume out there, and we're missing just the joy. And then don't do this, don't touch that. Fear-based Christianity, and it stifles us. It stifles our heart, our creativity, who we love, who we associate with. God says, you are always with me. Everything that God has is yours. We can enjoy it. I think sometimes we just need to relax as disciples. I know Sam sometimes says some of us look like we were baptized in vinegar. We walk around with that face like something's always wrong. This should be a joy. This should be great. We should be enjoying the fellowship with each other. We should not be thinking about, am I doing enough? Who's judging me here? And if you're in that kind of relationship, if you've been walking around, you've got to break the shackles free and start enjoying this gift that God has given us. He will run through the fields for you. He will push aside and sweep aside things and shed light to find you. Everything God has is yours. And you are always with Him, here and in heaven. If you're thinking about making a decision and trying to figure out what it's going to cost, it costs you nothing. Just let God find you. Just open your heart. In closing, God is your shield, your very great reward. He will give you the freedom to reject Him. He will let you even cut yourself off from Him. He will send you away out there with all of your gifts and talents, but He will protect you from guilt and shame when you decide to come back. He will run to the edge of town to meet you. He will protect you from the judgment of others, and He will accept you back instantly. He will throw a party for you and let you know He is always with you, and everything that He has is yours. Amen.
You've just listened to the Westchester Podcast. For more information about our ministry, please visit westchester.nyc.coc.net.